Right, well, welcome everybody to the first of the Stirling Institute for People-Centred Healthcare Management seminars. My name is Mike Walsh, and I'm the chair of the Institute. And the Institute is a collaboration between the Department of Nursing and Midwifery, which is headed up by Billy Lauder, who sat in the room, and Professor Roger Sugden, who's the director of the Management School. And you have the Management School and Nursing Midwifery coming together to create an interdisciplinary institute. I'm a former charge nurse and I'm a management scientist, so I have a foot in both camps, both on healthcare and in management. And I've got a strong interest in the way that health services are planned and delivered. And what we're focusing on in this seminar are the problems of working and delivering healthcare in remote and rural communities. Now, for Scotland, we have a particular issue, a particular problem or difficulty that we face, which is we've got a lot of people spread over a very large area, particularly in the Highlands. But actually, also, there are other parts of Scotland that are affected by this. Similarly, in Ghana, we also have, with James Antwi, who's the Assistant Director of Human Resources for Ghana, we're talking about the problems faced by the Ghanaian people in remote and rural Ghana, which is a very large area. Just to give you an example of the problem that people in Ghana face, we have in the UK approximately one doctor per 1,000 of population, one medically qualified healthcare professional, a doctor. So not any of the other professions. But in Ghana, in remote Ghana, you have one health worker per 90,000 people. So there is a big difference. One doctor per 1,000, one health worker per 90,000 people. Huge difference between the two communities. The first part of the seminar is going to be given by Pam Nicol, who's the Programme Director for National Health Service Education Scotland, for NES. For remote and rural, remote and rural education. I think it's called RIO, isn't it? And it's there. The Remote and Rural Healthcare Education Alliance. I should always look at the screen behind me. And Pam will be describing some of the issues, but then we also have the project lead, Fiona Fraser, will be talking about how this can be delivered. Well, you'll explain that later. And then we'll have James, who'll be talking about remote and rural Ghana and issues of recruitment and retention of healthcare workers in Ghana. I think this is a particularly important agenda for an institute in healthcare management. We have lots of big urban centres with huge concentration of resources, but actually we have lots of people who live outside of the cities in rural areas, and yet maybe policy is actually more orientated towards the urban areas and less towards people who live actually outside the cities. So I think this is crucial for the health and welfare of everybody else, and maybe there's something that needs to happen to the policy agenda. Maybe there needs to be a shift away from dominance by the big concentrations towards the people who live and actually who are probably largely responsible for the possibility of urban concentrations and cities, because cities and urban areas do not exist of their own right. They have a context, and that context is rural and it's often very remote. So let me start with Pam.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about our work in remote and rural education across Scotland. Today I'm going to try to limit myself to speak mainly about those issues pertinent to recruitment and retention that are the real drivers behind our work programme in RIO. And we shorten it to RIO, and often find myself falling into the trap of talking to people about, oh yes, we have a RIO team, and of course in the RIO building, in the RIO office, which sounds incredibly arrogant, but it's just a lot shorter than saying Remote and Rural Healthcare Education Alliance each time. So forgive me if I shorten it to RIO for those purposes this afternoon. So I'm going to try to tailor my short talk this afternoon around the specific recruitment and retention issues for providing healthcare across remote and rural Scotland that are really the drivers for us existing at all. Why do we exist? Why do you need a specific education body looking at the healthcare needs for healthcare staff providing across remote and rural Scotland? And today our particular interest is making comparison with our colleagues in Ghana in terms of remote and rural provision across Ghana from a sharing of knowledge point of view and from a, very much from a learning point of view. So I'm going to briefly describe a little bit of our work in real and what it is that this means and who we are. We've been commissioned by the Scottish Government. We sit as part of NHS Education for Scotland, which is a particular health board charged with assisting in delivering education solutions for healthcare staff across Scotland. And as I said before, our particular role is in ensuring that education that's developed is inclusive and fully meets the needs of staff who deliver their care within remote and rural areas in Scotland. Our actual role, we're a very small team, largely based in Inverness, but some of our colleagues based in Glasgow. We work across all of Scotland from a remote and rural point of view. We're working with Dumfries and Galloway, with Borders, with the Arran part of Ayrshire and Arran. And in fact, increasingly, we're less and less exclusive about what that might mean. If we're finding a solution, and it's helpful to colleagues in remote and rural parts or rural parts of Lanarkshire, for example, then that's absolutely fine. What I like to think we're about is finding practical solutions that will work well for our staff who are delivering care in remote and rural areas, and trying to find solutions that will be transferable for other staff groups across the other remote and rural areas and elsewhere and beyond. We work with all professional groups, so we work with doctors, we work with support workers, we work with nursing staff, right across the spectrum of those who deliver healthcare. And that brings many, many benefits we find in terms of the learning to be shared. What's worked in one profession, we like to look at that model and try to find ways to apply that in other professions to problems as we come across them. Working alongside is an absolute crucial part, given that I've said we're a very small team. Our core business is to form alliances. We find and make no shame about the fact that we find the lead experts in particular areas, we work alongside them, and we hope the value that we bring is our close working with each of the remote and rural health boards in bringing two discussions and two tables what we understand to be the top priority needs within those remote and rural areas in terms of what is it that staff really need in terms of education or training this year or this month, and what do they need next month, and so on and so forth. In the current economic climate, we've got even more adept at that. I think all of us have had to do that. We're having discussions with the health boards that say to us, this month, what are your top five priorities? What are your top five education needs, training needs that we can actually begin to look at alongside you? And we can then find partners to come alongside that may well find have expertise in a particular area. For example, if we have particular needs for GPs, then we will work with our GP colleagues and establish together with the identified needs a GP specific solution. If there's a specific issue that is round about support workers and so on and so forth, we align ourselves with the correct people. And that includes working very closely with our colleagues in education, obviously, and taking their lead in terms of their expertise in education provision. We bring to the table the need and the gap that we believe exists out there, or the need for education to be adapted very often so that actually it can be accessed by those who work within a remote and rural area and work together in a very genuine partnership way to achieve practical results. As I said before, we are very fortunate in terms of our positioning that we're very well supported by the Scottish Government. The Scottish Government, in producing this document some 3 years ago, put the rubber stamp on recognising that there actually were specific education needs and specific training needs and specific resource needs for providing healthcare services across remote and rural areas in Scotland. That's incredibly important. We have it in black and white. And for us, starting off 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, in fact, now, as REAL, this has been an incredibly useful document. I use it liberally as my support to say, well, remember we said this is what we're doing, this is still what we're true to. So it summarises the shape of remote and rural services that the government would like us to develop, and it also has summarised to begin with some of the gaps or holes in current education and training provision. So for us it's been a very helpful document and a very strengthening document, and it's our recourse back to Scottish Government. I like to say that we have been very lucky in having heavy support from the Scottish Government. That can be read both ways, heavy support or heavy monitoring, but either way we're very well we have very good communications back to Scottish Government because we're charged with delivering the education part of this document. It stood us in good stead. And just to try to summarise that and hopefully to make clear where we sit, the real part then, we work with our key partners, with the rest of NHS Education for Scotland. The strategic engagement pink box is really just what I've described, our specific commitment to work with, to meet with, to day-to-day speak with remote and rural health boards at a formal strategic level. We do that, and also on the ground at front face with frontline staff in order that we have any right to claim to understand what the education needs are and what the priorities are. That's an absolutely vital part of our role. So I hope from that diagram you begin to get a little bit of a sense that we're a linking role very often between what we understand to be the collective needs across the remote and rural areas for education and training, and a meeting with our education partners to try and convey those needs and to try and find together practical solutions to the problems as we come across them, or I should say to spread the word where we find solutions and opportunities for those to be picked up in other areas. So just moving on a little bit then, as was said in the introduction, the task in Scotland in terms of addressing remote and rural healthcare provision, I think is quite well illustrated by this map. In Scotland, the government uses this specific method, the sixfold method of describing what is remote and what is rural, and basically, the areas in yellow here are what are defined by the Scottish Government as remote rural for Scotland. So you can see quite surprisingly that there's a huge area. 94% of the landmass in Scotland is actually defined as remote and rural, which is quite incredible. The other areas round the edge in blue that you don't see quite so well are what are defined as rurally accessible areas. So those are areas that are rural but can access, for example, vital services like GP surgeries, community amenities within a sort of 30-mile car drive. So they're rural but they have accessible services nearby. The red areas are the bigger urban clusters, as you would recognise. And what's really interesting in terms of numbers is that we have just over 5 million people in Scotland, 5.2 million people, and 1 million of those, sort of roughly 20% of those, live and work in a remote and rural area in Scotland. So what you have is quite an interesting geography whereby you have a fairly distinct part of the population, the 1 million people who live in remote and rural areas, dispersed over an incredibly wide geography of Scotland there. So dispersed from, you know, Dumfries and Galloway down there in the south, right up to Wick, Shetland, Orkney, Western Isles, all around there. So you have a large landmass and a widely dispersed community, and that's quite important to understand when we start to think about how we provide health services, of course, and also from our point of view, how we actually provide adequate education support, training to people who are working in these outlying areas. Just again to set the context a little bit more, this just explains the 82% of the landmass there, whereby we have the sort of paler blue area refers to the population in contrast to the landmass. So we have the interesting situation where in Scotland 6% of the people living in the urban live in the 6% of the landmass, with 82% of the population living in these areas, which is just an interesting configuration. Again, as I move towards identifying some of the issues that relate to recruitment and retention then, and some of the challenges in providing services and education across this patch, as I'll call it, the remote and rural patch, the big yellow bits and the pale blue bits in my language. As you're probably aware, Also, we've come to understand that we have significantly different population dispersals in remote and rural areas as well in Scotland. So we have a much lower percentage in the age band of 16 to 34 in the remote and rural areas, and a much higher percentage in the age band of 40 to 74, which I'll go on to talk about a little bit more when we describe workforce challenges. This diagram here with its little helicopter coming into land is an attempt to try to simplify the plan, the blue book that I displayed at the beginning, Delivering for Remote and Rural Healthcare, that's been laid out for us by the Scottish Government, that's been agreed. This is a type of plan in terms of that the Scottish Government have agreed in terms of how remote and rural health services should and can be delivered. So I'm not going to go into it in a great deal of detail, as you might be pleased to hear, but very briefly, what you see there, the blue circle on the outside, the extended community care team, and this also includes a huge wealth of primary care, of community staff working in the community, providing care locally within communities, particularly within the remote and rural communities. Moving in closer, we have what we would term secondary care, so you're much more into specialised care or hospital care. We have 6 rural general hospitals in Scotland, and we also have, of course, district general hospitals, the bigger hospitals serving the bigger populations, for example, Raigmore. We also have in Scotland then other hospitals that we term community hospitals. There's a great deal of debate over the definitions between these, but I think it's helpful to define them to some extent within these categories. So we have 72 community hospitals as well. So getting closer to the nub of what we're talking about today, the job in hand at the moment is in order to provide the best possible care and to give people living and working indeed within the remote and rural communities access to the best levels of care, we have to be continually monitoring how we support the workforce in order that the workforce can be well supported and well educated, the bottom line being so that they can deliver safe and effective healthcare services to patients within remote and rural areas. But as you see from this diagram, there are degrees then of access and there are degrees of services that are delivered dependent on what's available actually, and also where you live, how remote or how rural you are in terms of your location. So for example, you'll have living within a remote or rural area, there'll be people in the audience who maybe can tell me better than this, you would expect a number of core services to be available within your local area from your community team. You would expect that there will be some services a little bit more specialist you'll have to travel to hospital for, but that might well be to a fairly local community hospital. There'll be other services that you would expect to travel to your bigger rural general hospital for, Belford and Fort William, for example, or the hospitals that are in Orkney or in Shetland. The particular task in hand at the moment is in actually maintaining these services. And the reason we stand here today, that we have the support from the Scottish Government to invest in education, is in order that we have a workforce who are fit for purpose, who are well trained, who can provide services safely and effectively for patients. And part of the issues relating to recruitment and retention that we've been discussing with colleagues from Ghana today relate to just how we continue to staff this level of provision, how we continue to support staff to be able to provide locally and to do that really, really well, where that's what's required by the patient and that's what's effective, how we can still maintain the rural general hospitals, where we have actually a reduced number of trainee doctors at the moment, where we have difficulty recruiting specific members of staff, for example, consultants, to staff the full rota that we need to have in place to be able to provide in the rural general hospitals the full range of services that patients may need. So in a very short version today, and I'm racing, the task in hand is really to look very, very carefully at, have we got this right? Are we still going to be able to do it this way in 5 years? Are there people within the hospital teams at the moment who can safely be educated and skilled up to provide high quality care, but different people perhaps than those who provide it at the moment? And very much our task is about helping to sustain as well as improve these services in order that those of us living in and working in remote and rural areas can expect to access good quality healthcare provision and increasingly social care provision as well, either within our local area or within a reasonable distance. And I think the message here is about having equity of access to the right care at the right time when you need it, be that local care or specialist care within a hospital setting. So, very, very briefly, the challenges that we are looking at through education and trying to address are about sustaining access, as I've said before, about trying to recruit sufficient and correctly trained people into the workforce to staff the community teams and to staff the hospital teams, the community hospitals, the rural general hospitals. We have a particular problem with that, despite best efforts, whereby, in common with a lot of colleagues in other countries, at times the remote and rural posts are not seen to be as attractive as some of the posts in the bigger specialist areas. And we're working, and Fiona will talk a little bit about our ideas that we have to try and address that in trying to increase the status of being a remote and rural specialist, working with a broad range of patients across a broad area, in contrast to being having a very profession-specific role within perhaps a big urban hospital. We have the issues of where the future workforce will come from within the remote and rural areas. At the moment, with the population information that we looked at a few moments ago, we can see that we have a decreasing pool of younger population to draw on, traditionally where we would take people from, and we're having to think very creatively then about offering education that enables people to be flexible, to change from having been trained in one area into being able to train in another area, being able to work longer and being part of the healthcare provision team, and looking at how we provide education to support that kind of change in the workforce as well, now and 5 years and in 10 years' time. So, this map probably illustrates best of all what I've been trying to convey this afternoon. Our task from an education point of view, how that impacts on patient services, is in us getting our job right and finding appropriate practical ways to support the staff who are out there in these areas. The blue dot areas are the most peripheral areas that we have, in this instance, GP practices. And this is those practices that are in the most remote areas in relation to traditional sites of learning, so their access to hospitals as a teaching facility or to education establishments. So our task, if you like, within the real team is to make sure all the education developments that come forward now and in the future are applicable for those staff who are providing care within these blue dot areas and elsewhere across remote and rural Scotland. Okay, and I've been told to stop here, so I will stop. I'd said I would try to give a summary and overview. Fiona's going to go on to talk about some of the ways that we're doing that very briefly before we go on to hear about the experiences in Ghana, maybe some of the similarities that we have there. So thank you very much for listening for that part. Okay, do you want that bit or the next bit?
Good afternoon, everybody. It's good to see you. I'm going to carry on and speak, I hope, very briefly and speak about particular areas of work that REAL are moving forward with in terms of supporting and aiding retention and enhancing recruitment to remote and rural. So far, Pam set the scene in terms of the need for origin for REAL in terms of its origin, why it was necessary to have a separate institution taking forward education solutions for remote and rural. As REAL came into being 2.5 years ago, there was also an acknowledgement across the boards within Scotland that there were significant issues with the skill set, the psychomotor skills, the interpersonal skills, not in terms of gaining those skills within remote and rural, but maintaining that skill set within remote and rural. Remote and rural practitioners are expected to be generalist specialists, masters of all things, and taking that into account with the variability of the patient population they see. A remote and rural practitioner can have grave concerns about managing an emergency situation. They can train and retrain, that might only see one or two instances of that over a year period. So there was an acknowledgement at this time that there was a need for moving forward and supporting skills maintenance and development of remote and rural practitioners, and that's the workforce across the board, along with some accompanying educational solutions. I'm going to speak about two specific areas just now. As REAL came into being, as I said, there was this acceptance, there was a problem with maintaining the skill set of remote and rural practitioners and providing education in an accessible form to those people that were joining the workforce or indeed wanting to reskill. And of course, this is coming in a backdrop of a health model that was changing with an increasing focus on primary care delivery, early discharge from hospital and acute care, and supporting patients in their own home. So there's almost a need for redesigning traditional roles, particularly within the remote and rural areas. The Clinical Skills Alliance, as an activity sponsored by Scottish Government and NHS Education for Scotland, drew up a strategy and along with that a survey looking at particular needs for the remote and rural workforce in Scotland. There was a high number of respondents to a survey issued at that time, and people were very clear with regard to the type of education they wanted. And in fact, Michelle is in the audience and she used to work alongside some of the skills team in Dundee, and colleagues in Dundee led on this activity. Maybe she'll be able to help with some queries later. The survey found that there were 10 particular areas ranging from interpersonal skills to psychomotor tasks to highly specialised surgical techniques that people wanted an opportunity to practice and perform. The aim being, of course, to improve confidence, competence and capability, but at the same time maintaining this ability to sustain a service in remote and rural areas. And I suspect there are many similarities between our own needs and the situation that Ghana's finding themselves in as well. This needs to be done in a very cost-effective way and in a way acknowledging the problems and the challenges that can be faced with travelling with a service across remote and rural Scotland. So there was a project pilot which is running until December, the end of this year, run by the Clinical Skills Managed Educational Network, and this is a mobile unit. Some people refer to it as Skills Bus, but we're not really allowed to say that. The Skills Unit is mobile, can cross ferries and reach the majority of even the outer isles within Scotland, providing a facility to deliver quite detailed clinical skills education. There is some support from this body in training staff within the localities, within the regions, the idea being that rather than trainers coming in as consultants providing training and then leaving an area, that there's the development of the training ability within the region itself, and that service then becomes embedded within local educational practice. The mobile units are seen to be incredibly cost-effective. The majority, I think, training of 800-plus practitioners over the course of last year with a cost of about £30 per head, which is seen as a terribly efficient mode of delivery. And given the service pressures, the problems that we've had recently with transport within UK and the problems of volcanic ash and flights being cancelled, the ability of training to go to remote and rural workforces rather than them having to travel to urban centres is a particular boon. The other model of skills delivery, which has been accentuated recently and works alongside the Clinical Skills Mobile Unit, is BASICS, a highly credible and well-regarded organisation, a charitable institution that links in with BASICS UK, essentially led by GPs, or not exclusively, delivering remote and rural education to initially general practitioners, but now a broader interface, a broader catchment of the workforce in the remote and rural areas. They're multidisciplinary in their involvement, both in terms of the trainers and their audience, the delegates that they capture. They focus on adult, paediatric and maternal acute care. They can focus on a particular health board priority area. And they're, as I say again, they take training to the area of delivery. This is a classical setup of the way that BASICS will deliver. They travel with a Bedford van and a trailer, quite a tightly packed unit, using trainers, often some from the Central Belt and some within the remote and rural locality. So there is a degree of partnership and an understanding of local practice, local protocol and local challenges as well. They'll set up a moulage or a simulation. They can be joining in with trainers from a remote site, using VC heavily in terms of their mode of delivery. And that's something that they're accentuating now with the difficulties of access to trainers and training time. So these are ways that the skills component of education in terms of moving forward, remote and rural was progressing. There was a need for something further. There was a need for further support in terms of matching with the strategic engagement of REAL and matching the strategic priorities of the health board, but so to speak, meeting the needs of the workforce at the coal face. Some form of double-ended solution that could provide some support. The medium that REAL's moving forward, and half of my particular post in terms of moving project forward, is REACH, Remote Education for Communities Health. What does that mean? What does it do? Our hope is that this will be a one-stop shop for accessing, sourcing information and delivery of remote and rurally contextually appropriate education. It'll be an electronic platform, a platform by which people access information and evidence base, reusable learning assets as a composite. Now that could be e-learning modules, mediums, it could be banded or streamed vignettes or video footage to look at and review their skill set alongside expert clinical practice. This will be something that is all inclusive and will be accessible, as I say, via the web to remote and rural practitioners. Our brand of a distributed education platform, by that we mean geographically distributed, distributed to a very diverse health workforce, and that has to take into account the increasing role that healthcare support workers will play in the delivery of healthcare within the remote and rural area, particularly in form of redesign and re-educating people for new roles and development roles. Access to this form of education retains the workforce within a remote and rural location and provides career opportunities to prevent this outward migration, which is so important in Scotland at the moment. Our approach, as I've alluded to, will be a very blended, a consistent system for delivering, tracking and recording learning. Now, before somebody poses the question, what about connectivity and capacity in Scotland? Our electronic highways are quite full. Our hope and intention is that the learning products, the tools that we have accessible here for those people with a suboptimal broadband connection will be able to access by alternate means, obviously with planning, and that's something that we'll liaise. We're linking in with Highlands and Islands and some of the other geographical areas in terms of the problems with connectivity in Scotland, and this is actually something in recognition of the way that we want to move forward. We're linking in strategically with other organisations because connectivity is a key in terms of moving education forward within Scotland, and I suspect a significant challenge in other regions. There's a real need to develop reusable learning assets. Some years ago in Scotland, there was a well-regarded VC education programme, NOSTEP, NEXTEP. Some people in the audience might be familiar with that. REAL, in some ways, will move forward with this VC type of educational system, the difference being that we'll be recording, as we are perhaps today, and reusing information so that practitioners in remote and rural situation can actually access at a time that's appropriate to them, as well as enjoying a situation at a timed incident. Significantly alongside this, REACH, along with REACH in developing this platform, and we're linking in with key support from the knowledge services within NHS Education for Scotland, developing our links with Basics and the Skills Network. What we're also doing is looking at tools or products that we can use to enhance delivery by this medium. REAL's developing a VC education package that we're wanting to make available broadly so that people's confidence with using VC is promoted. But that's both confidence of the deliverer in terms of the educator, but confidence of those people that are receiving VC education. This is technology that some people are a little wary of. We want to encourage that because this is a very efficient mode of delivery. But along with that, we're also developing quality assurance guidelines for distance delivery of education. Now that will be distance learning, distance mentoring and distance supervision. This is of particular significance when looking at support of the remote and rural workforce. Many people will look at remote and rural locations as a lifestyle destination, highly desirable in terms of home location, familial support, particularly those with younger families, as long as they can get access to the service they need and their career can progress alongside that. If you're on one of the specialist rural tracks, which Pam spoke about briefly earlier, and you can get access without having to take a plane and cross a ferry and leave service and cope with all the problems there in terms of accessing mentorship, your clinical supervision, your educational support for higher learning, a remote and rural elective or a career destination point is a highly desirable position to be in. And that's something that REAL is progressing and there's significant interest in this area of work from many degree of stakeholders. So overall, we would hope that REAL is moving forward with REACH, our brand of a distributed education system. This is something that the Canadians, Scandinavia and the Australian societies are delivering well. We're starting to move forward this in terms of a version that suits Scotland, and we're encouraged that there's significant interest developing this mode of delivery. Thank you.
Well, thank you to Pam and thank you to Fiona for the presentations there. We won't take questions now because time is squeezed. What we will do instead is when James has finished his presentation, we're going to have some refreshments, and I believe that there is water and something else that has been magically transformed from water into, I think, wine. And we can pursue our discussions there. But I think the agenda is really very interesting. James, I'd like you to come forward. James Antwi is the Assistant Director of Human Resources for the Ministry of Health in Ghana, and he has a particular responsibility for tackling the problem of recruitment and retention of workers in remote and rural Ghana. James, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much, Tuna. I'd like to pay tribute to the Stirling University Institute of People-Centered Healthcare Management under the chair of Dr. Mike Walsh, and Anne Mason in Venice, and the head of Department of Nursing and Midwifery, NHS Highlands, for this great opportunity to present on the recruitment and retention issues in rural Ghana. I'm James M.G., Minister of Health, and I'm also an apprentice to Dr. Mike Walsh. he is supervising my research work. Thank you very much for this great opportunity. Ghana, in the late 90s and early 2000s, faced a human resource crisis. That is when we had our health professionals, nurses, doctors, midwives, they left the country for other developed countries like the UK. And in those days, the number of doctors who were working in New York were two times those who were in Ghana. The number of Ghanaian trained doctors working in New York. was that of twice those in Ghana. So there was the need for policy interventions to address that issue. And then some of the policies that we implemented, some worked, some didn't work. So we want to see why some worked and why some didn't work. And then we want to show that yes, probably most of the policies that we implemented were not based on evidence, and most of them we formulated without involving the local community. So this presentation will give me the opportunity to show you the issues with recruitment and retention, issues with out-migration, issues with policies, and issues with what we need to do as a next step. Ghana is located in the south coast of West Africa. Shares common boundaries with La Côte d'Ivoire on the west, Togo on the east, Burkina Faso on the north. Ghana has a rural population of about 55% of the total population. The projected population now is around 22 million, and the rural population is about 55% of that. Agric is the dominant profession in Ghana, and 41% of that contributes to the GDP. Agric also employs about 60% of the workforce, so you can see that it is the dominant profession in Ghana. Ghana has a decentralized administrative systems, and we have about 10 regions. The decentralized structures means that we have the national government, which is in Accra, then we have 10 administrative regions, and each region has district assembly or municipal or metropolitan assembly, depending on the population density of that area. Then the lowest administrative or government structure is what we call the unit assemblies. They are the lowest. I want to just show you some of the key economic and social indicators in Ghana. And then the most important thing to me is the what we call the maternal mortality rate, which is about 540 per 100,000 live births, which is quite an unacceptable figure for any country. And so there's the need for us to work towards that. The organization of health service in Ghana is under the policy, health policy, which serves to as an engine for wealth creation. That is what the policy of health is. It serves as an engine for wealth creation. And it operates on a three-tier sort of healthcare model, which is on both preventive and curative. We have the lowest structure, which is the community-based healthcare, the what we call the community health planning and integrated services. You can call it CHIPS, but it's not the CHIPS that we normally eat, but is the acronym of Community Health Planning and Integrated Services, where we assume that every 500 population, we have a healthcare provider in that community to provide basic healthcare to the people in that community. We call them the community health officers. Then we have the secondary care, which is provided at the district level, at the regional level, where we have specialists in the regional hospitals and sometimes specialists in the district hospitals to receive referrals and provide expert care to the people. Then the tertiary services, where we have the teaching hospitals, where we have the research institutions, and the tertiary training institutions. We have three teaching hospitals in Ghana, one in Accra, Kumasi, which is in the middle, and Tamale, which is in the north. The Tamale is not well developed to a higher level. But as of now, Kumasi and then Accra, they have the best teaching hospitals in the country. We have the MOA. Ghana's health service is structured similar to that of the UK. We have the Minister of Health, which is for policy policy formulation, resource mobilization, and coordination. Then we have the service delivery, we call the Ghana Health Service. That is the largest service delivery wing. They implement the policies, they provide health care, and we have the teaching hospitals providing tertiary care. And then we have the regulatory bodies that, like the councils, the Nursing and Midwifery Council, Medical and Dental Council, the Food and Drugs Board, the Pharmacy Council, and we also have the traditional medical council. So they deal with the traditional medicine practice in the country. So those are, and we have the research institutions and the training institutions. And health financing is basically through the National Health Insurance Authority. It's like the NHS, National Health Insurance, and the central government tax revenues, and then we have donors and partners also supporting health financing in Ghana. So just want to show you the picture of the health workforce in Ghana. And in 2003, we had a total of 39,000, and that has increased to 46,000 in 2009. And the composition, as you see, Ghana Health Service is the largest. It employs about 50% of the health workers in Ghana, and then psychiatric hospitals, the teaching hospitals, and the CHAG represent the mission institutions. The mission institutions, we call them CHAG institutions, also employ big chunk of health providers in Ghana. We, in Ghana, the gap now is the difficulty in knowing the number of health workers being employed by the private sector. That is the gap in literature that we are trying to identify. What you know about out-migration? We know that, yes, as I said, in the 1990s and early 2000s, there was that big global issue of out-migration, and then that affected developed countries like Ghana. Then it's not that people were only attracted, but inwardly, there were things, other factors that were pushing people out. And those are the factors. People wanted to develop themselves, and there were no opportunities for them to develop themselves. Doctors wanted to have specialized programs. There were no opportunities for them to have those specialized programs. Then, of course, the money factor also served as a push for others to leave. Then we had this pandemic of HIV/AIDS, which also affected the continent of Africa. And so people were fatigued, and they became exhausted, and they were absenting themselves from work and that sort of thing. So the environment was not that attractive for people to stay and contribute to healthcare delivery. And the effect of it is, as people left from urban areas, those but qualified in the rural areas also moved from rural areas to replace those who had left from the urban areas. So the effect of out-migration really affected the healthcare personnel density in rural areas. Then in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was the need. Yes, people are leaving, we are losing our health workforce. You can't just sit down, fold your arms, and just watch it to happen like that. So there was the need to implement policies that we thought would address that. And some of the policies was, one, to increase the number of students, increase the number of trainees, expand the training schools, build new schools so that, yes, we can increase the number of health workers. So the production was tackled. Then, too, we realized that, yes, doctors were leaving because they were complaining about lack of other opportunities to improve themselves. So government set up the Ghana College of Surgeons and physicians and surgeons to at least train doctors locally so that they will not move. One thing is people left for specialized training and they didn't even return. So that was the need to have a local training program for them. Then the other issue was, yes, let's put in systems and structures that will help make them, motivate them, make them happy. So there was the need for accreditation and regulation. There was the need to redesign curriculum that will make sure that, yes, we have training components that support local people, that support local communities. And there was this salary rationalization in 2006. Before 2006, the nurse in Australia received 18 times what the nurse in Ghana was receiving. And in 2006, there was the need to increase the salary of health workers, which was a very big political issue because, yes, other workers in the country also complained that you have increased the salaries of health workers. What about us? So you need a very political will to take that decision, and we enforce it. Then we have engaged in other projects we call the Brain Gain program with MIDA, IOM, Migration of International Development, on how we can get Ghanaians in diaspora back on short-term basis to help us build capacity and to provide services in that area. Then there was the need for Ghana Health Workforce Observatory to serve as a network of getting experts from all fronts, from all ministries, from all directories to have a common meeting like this and look at the common agenda and see what together we can do to find solutions to the problem that we had then. So that is the outcome, and that is the projected indicators for the health policy to address production and to address clinical issues. And when you look at it, you see that the policy on production was to train more of the middle-level health workforce, because we realized that the middle-level health workforce were those who were ready to stay in the country, those who will also even go to rural areas to work. So that is what. The second one was also to increase the number of clinicians, because when you look at the composition of the health workforce, you see that most of them are support workers. So we said that, yes, let's increase the production of clinicians so that we can tackle most of the clinical issues that we are facing. So out of those measures and policies, we can see the trend of attrition in Ghana. It's gone down from 2001 to 2006 for all categories of health workers, for medical doctors, for pharmacists, for nurses and midwives. Their attrition has gone down dramatically. What we have today, that is the challenges of HIV, and we no matter what we say, no matter what policies, these are the challenges. We've got to work with them. Because, yes, we have modernized medicine. And as you modernize something, there are some of the consequences that we've got to deal with. Modern medicine has advanced in such a way that, yes, we are producing new drugs. We are producing technology. And we need to train our people to be able to know how to use the technology, know how to dispense the new drugs. And so we have more on our hands to fulfill. And that is the technology we are producing. Now, you produce people for specific assignments, for specific reasons. And so you need to even train more people to be able to take care of modern medicine and advances in medicine. The problem with rural health workforce in Ghana is, yes, the effect of migration, out migration, has had a dramatic consequence on health workers in rural areas. Then we are seeing that lack of appropriate skills of health workers, career progression, in-service training, continuing professional education is also affecting them, and so is affecting health workers in rural areas. Then we are saying that the distribution of qualified health workers in Ghana is highly skewed in favor of the urban areas. And so most of the rural facilities depend on auxiliary health staff. Measures adopted in the past to help address rural area issue. Yeah, we in 2005 we implemented what we call the deprived area incentive package. That time we had 128 districts. Then we selected 55 of those districts. The criteria we used the criteria that was basically on social factors, that areas that were deprived of social amenities like good roads, like electricity, like good water facilities, areas deprived of telephone connectivity, areas deprived of good infrastructure. Then we also look at even urban areas that are economically depressed. And we also use areas that we felt people would not easily accept posting to. So that was the criteria. Ministry of Health own criteria, we sat in the ministry, we designed our own criteria and just say, okay, let's pick these areas. So we picked those areas and we said, let's give 25% of the person's basic salary as an additional incentive. So those who are working in those areas, we give you additional 25% of your basic salary. Those who want to go, we give you additional 25% of your salary. We implemented that for 6 months, and we evaluated the outcome. What we realized that, yes, people thought we were discriminatory in the selection process, the areas that we selected. And then the deprived area incentive was we targeted that on only core clinicians, not all health workers. So other health workers came back and said, okay, health care is a teamwork. If we prefer you are only giving this to doctors and nurses, okay, let them do the work. We will not do this. We will not do that. And so we realized that it was not implemented properly. Then the other issue is the doctor said, 25% you are giving me, I can get about 3 times of that in the cities by doing locum to my additional work. So why should I stay here? And so it really didn't work for us. Then we said, okay, let's do composite sort of posting. After all, when you graduate from high school, from university as a doctor, your first assignment is to post you to rural area, whether you like it or not. That will also look at a centralized structure, which will have that sort of power to say, okay, go and don't go. And there were big human rights issues on that. Then we said, okay, let's decentralize HR. Okay, HR is decentralized. At the regional level, you have your budget. You know how much you have to pay for doctors, to recruit new doctors, to recruit new nurses. But what we didn't do at that time, which was difficult, which was more of a central national issue, was we couldn't decentralize the money. We decentralized all the documents, all the papers. We set up the structures. Let's get HR managers at the regional level, at the district level. But we couldn't give them the money. So the money remained in Accra. And then we decided to implement the policies, and it didn't work. Then we said, okay, let's give them fellowships, scholarships, those working in rural areas. And that one varied sources because one, because people, because of leadership issues and management issues, managers at the lower level couldn't implement that properly. And so these are the issues that we confronted and we further. Yes, they are very good ideas, very good intentions to get people to rural areas, to make people, help workers in rural areas comfortable. They are not working properly. So we pause and we look for evidence, and we take something from what John Ruskin said, that we were not sent into this world to do things into which our hearts do not put. And there is a famous English poet from 1819 to 1900. I want us to look at the evidence, what is happening with health workforce distribution in rural in Ghana. That is the distribution. You look at the total health workforce, and that is from the 2008 pay rule. And the Upper East, Upper West, Upper UWR is the Upper West region, and UWE is the Upper East region. And a total composition of about 40,000, and they have 3.3% and 4.4%. And you look at Greater Accra region, that GAR, that has the highest of 21.something%. And Ashanti region also has the highest. Ashanti is AR, about 17%. But somebody will say, oh, they are just the total workforce. What about the population density in the Upper West region? Anne will tell you that the population is dispersed. It's not highly dense as in Greater Accra. So we look at that and the population as well. Yes, we are presenting this graphically on the medical officer, specialist, professional nurse, midwife, and the community health. Community health nurses are auxiliary nurses. They are certificate. They attend 2-year program, and they are given certificates as community health nurses. But that is the representation per capita. You look at the figure on the far right is representing doctors. And we see the northern region has the highest, that means the highest, the number of population per doctor. The northern region has the highest number of population per doctor. So as Upper West and Upper East. Greater Accra is doing very, very well. They are down there. The number of doctors to population is not that bad because we have a very big teaching hospital where we have all the specialists, where we have all the experts located. When you look at the other graph, we have the top one represent the nurses and the down one represent the total workforce. When you look at the composition of the total workforce, you see that it's relatively better, not as bad as breaking, separating them, segregating them into various groups. It means that most of the regions have more of the auxiliary staff, more of the non-professional staff making up the number of health workforce in those regions. WHO suggests that, yes, for each country to attain 80% of coverage delivery, you need 2.43 of the doctor or midwife or nurse to be able to achieve that. And when you look at the Ghanaian and the regional distribution, you see that the medical doctor density and the nurse midwife density, we are far, far below what WHO suggests. And you look at the outpatient and attendance and HR implications. You can, from this data, you can see that, yes, in the regions, the workload is too much for nurses and for midwives and for doctors as compared to the teaching hospitals. Then we have varied ratios also among the health professionals in the teaching hospitals and in the district hospitals and in the regions. A rural area in Ghana is, that is the typical scene that you often see. Health workers, like community health workers, are normally giving motorbikes and they will have to cross streams and rivers from one area to other to provide healthcare services. And that is a typical health worker crossing the river with the motorbike. She's a female with a motorbike to the other side to provide routine healthcare services. Health workers in Ghana, issues with health workforce is global. It's global. From Chris Ham indicated in 1982 that, yes, even in Britain, issues, as my sister said, issues with health workforce in rural area existed, and it continues to exist. So what we are saying that, yes, we can tackle that based on this sort of framework, that, yes, we got to identify the problem with the workers, with the communities, and let's get the factors, which factors that are preventing people from working in rural areas, factors that are pushing people away from rural areas, factors that are not attractive, together with the communities, together with the health workers. It's not that somebody was be at the policy level and just take decisions and want people to implement at the lower level. So if we are able to do that and identify, then we see how we can change the factors that are not working. That is where implementation science will come in. That is where we can use the resource chain to address implementing the issues. And we can't do that in isolation. What we are saying that we can only do that if we identify the organizational structure, the procedures, and the process in the organization, if we can identify the HR systems, HR management, motivation issues, and others in the organization, if we can look at it from an economic point of view. Yes, Though you need the help for this, you want them to go to right ways. They may need that, they may need that, they may need that. Do you have the will to address that? You may need them, but maybe there's the envelope to pay them is not there. So why do you worry yourself? So these are the issues. So you look at the labor market forces, the supply and demand issues, and the economies of it to see if with all these things, you will be able to address that. And if you conceptualize it in this way, then you'll be able to find solutions to contribute to improving the health outcomes in the communities. What the literature is saying about, yes, the importance of human beings for healthcare delivery. You can't only rely on technology. Technology cannot do the trick. You need the human beings to do the work. And that is all that literature is saying. So we decided to experiment some of these things, how we can get the people to understand the issues, the problems, and then with the rural areas. And that was to get 6 districts in one of the most deprived regions in Ghana to pick health workers, community leaders, policymakers, planners to meet at one central point to address the issue, to identify with them that, yes, this is a problem, and for them to understand the issue. What we did initially was to try to see, okay, yes, if we don't have health workers, what is the effect? So we tried to do some econometric analysis to see the effect of human beings on health outcomes. And we picked 3 indicators, the under 5 mortality rate, the infant mortality rate, and the maternal mortality rate. And we used doctors to do our comparison. And when you look at the graphs, you see that, yes, in the regions where we don't even have more doctors, upper west, upper east, northern region, those figures are doing well. They are competing with regions where we have. So we said, so why? What is it that, yes, they don't have doctors, but maternal mortality is not that bad as we thought. When you look at infant mortality, it's not that bad as we thought. When you look at under 5 mortality, is it that bad as we thought? So these are the issues. But what we didn't do was that, yes, we couldn't generalize this because, one, we took just few areas to do the analysis. So this couldn't be generalized. The other thing that also came out was that, yes, maybe this could be possible in a way, because looking at infant mortality and under 5 mortality, you see that, yes, if you get a team of healthcare providers and they are committed and they are ready to work, it doesn't necessarily need an expert to, because most of them are preventive issues. Infant mortality, you give the mother the education, and you give the mother the routine services, I think it can control that. For under 5 mortality, yes, if we do that, we educate the people and we visit them regularly, we can control that. The maternal issue is the most important, where we need a skilled birth. And that one is clear that one is, you can see the differences among the maternal. But the under 5 and the infant, they are not that much differences. So what we are saying that, yes, there is the need. People there doing the stakeholder workshops with communities, with policymakers, with health workers, they identify that, yes, there is the need for improvement in the health, the number of health workers in rural areas. 2, they also identify that, yes, they need to come together to work to find solutions to that problem. Then they realize that, yes, the existing policies are not working because they were designed somewhere and they were dumped on them for them to implement. So, yes, they didn't involve the local communities. They didn't involve the health workers themselves. What we need to do as policymakers is to look at this and say, okay, yes, we want to address this issue. We have tried other measures. It didn't work. We have tested it, and we have realized that, yes, people feel we didn't involve them in designing those policies. So now what we need to go back to the people and use that concept, identify the problem with them, find out the factors, and use the system, the organizational structures, the human resource issues, and the economic concept context to find a very decent way, a very decent package, very decent, attractive things that we need to do to get our health workers to rural areas. And together with Sterling, with NHS Highland, we can engage the people. Then we are saying that together we can design the schemes, and together we will realize that, yes, this is where we need to be, and we can make a lot of improvement in health outcomes. And together we train and deploy our forces to combat the diseases and the disabilities in our society. That is our health workforce, highly motivated and retained at all levels. Thank you very much.
Thank you to James. It is quite late, so I think what we should do is go and find our refreshments and have our conversations outside. But thank you very much, James. Thank you, Pamela. Thank you to Fiona and NHS Education Scotland. Thank you.